Welcome everyone to the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Spicer, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, my co-host is Grand Poopah, Jason McMaster.
Hello.
For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, I was on the Quarter 3 Games podcast this week, and things got a little, I guess, weird, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, Tom did a quiz about Payday 2, or Payday characters, and it was like this weird game he came up with, and I ended up winning. And the prize was everybody had to call me Sir, but nobody wanted to call me Sir because it sounded weird, so it ended up being all sorts of different.
Yeah, we managed to just completely skirt around the issue for the whole cast.
Yes.
And I will, of course, have a link to that lovely cast at the bottom of this one. So, for this week, I guess starting off with, how's everything going with you, Jason?
Oh, it's going well. Going well. Just working on Quarter to Three, writing stuff and design-wise, and things are good. Things are good. How about you?
It's all right. I've been just doing some like side jobs in the meantime just to get some money, getting hooked on Payday. And I finished Dragon's Crown the other night.
Yeah, you were, you mentioned it, I think, it was mentioned briefly. I don't know if it was, did you mention it, or was it?
Rob brought up, I think that was his game of the week, yeah.
Okay, yeah, but you didn't like Dragon's Crown, though, did you?
I'm sort of, I guess, average about it. More, like, I guess, underwhelmed with it than anything else. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, Dragon's Crown is the latest game from Vanillaware. They're a company that specializes in 2D, I guess it's considered hand-drawn, but I know one of our previous guests sort of went into detail about like, sort of like their animation style for it. And so Dragon's Crown has been in the news regarding its art design. Essentially, they're going for a super over-exaggerated style. So this is a game where, you know, men look like professional bodybuilders on, you know, 10 different steroids. Women have breasts bigger than their heads. All that lovely good stuff. And, of course, there's been articles and debates over the last few months about it. There was a big debate when Polygon gave it, I think, a 6 or a 5 out of 10 the other week. Yeah, I know. They went below the 7 to 10 scale.
Yeah. Wow, that's just shocking. It must have done something wrong if they broke out of the old 7 to 10.
Mm-hmm. And the debate is about whether it's all right to have women basically being sexually depicted like that, even though they have the men basically as, you know, the super buff alpha male type characters. And I was of the mind that I think it's all right on one hand that everyone is basically over-exaggerated, at least in terms of the main cast. But on the other hand, there's definitely a lot more scenes and a lot more images of women in basically suggestive poses. There's like one scene with like a mermaid, you know, of course, no bra and all that stuff right on the screen. And there's definitely more of that. And there's that debate about, you know, oh, it's, you know, old school fantasy, so it's all right. But then people say, oh, but that's old school fantasy was pretty much sexist in that regards.
It's very true. It's also kind of boring in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. But
yeah, it just feels kind of weird by the fact that outside of the main cast, there's, I would say, four, maybe, my mind is blanking on me right now, but I know there's at least five main scenes of, like, women in very seductive, suggestive poses that you'll see as you're playing through the game. And then the rest of the content, or in terms of art, is unlockable artwork. Every time you complete a quest or do something else, you'll unlock, like, various artwork done by the team. So there's maybe a scene of women standing someplace, or, you know, a man fighting, like, a giant whale or something like that. And it's all done in the same sexualized art style, but it just feels somewhat, I guess, out of place with the beat-em-up nature of the game.
Oh, yeah, no, I can certainly see that. It's just, I don't know, it's such a sticky subject.
Yeah, definitely. Now, in terms of what I didn't like about the game, just putting aside the art and everything, the gameplay, they sort of were going halfway between being just like a beat-em-up, like Final Fight, Streets of Rage, that kind of stuff, and then going with more of an action RPG, something like a Diablo way, Torchlight, when you have these six completely different character classes, there's randomized loot that you pick up in the levels. But it never really goes anywhere with that. When you level up, you can put points into two skill trees, but it's not anywhere as, I guess, freedom as something like Drox Operative, or even like the older Diablo games. The beat-em-up gameplay is really good, and this is coming from Vanillaware, who their last two games, Odin's Sphere and Muramasa, were largely 2D beat-em-up-ish type games. Did you play Dragon's Crown or any of Vanillaware's previous games?
I have not.
I know Muramasa was just released on the Vita, and I think people are raving about this because it looks a lot better with the smaller resolution screen compared to being up on the Wii.
Oh, right. Yeah, the Vita has a really nice resolution, too.
And speaking about the Vita, Dragon's Crown, this didn't have any effect on my review, but it was kind of weird, and we talked about this on the podcast the other night, was that you can cross-play it, meaning you can take your PS3 character or game and take it to the Vita and vice versa, but there's no cross-buy option. So the only way you can actually have that option is you have to buy both versions of the game.
Kind of sucks. But, I mean, yeah, no, that kind of sucks.
Yeah, definitely a weird choice, and I would think that something like this, where it has such a more simplistic gameplay, more about playing with your friends, that it would be great to have like a round, take it out when you're visiting people on the Vita, and then come back and, you know, hook it up to the PlayStation Network and play on that end.
Right. I mean, that's really cool, but it just kind of implies that there's no cross-buy, because I did that for the Monster Hunter, wasn't it the 3DS? Yeah, it was the 3DS.
There's cross-buy, oh yeah, that's right, the Monster Hunter 3DS, and then that was for the Wii U, I guess?
Yeah, Wii U and 3DS, and there was kind of some bundles here, good buy and stuff that were pretty reasonable, and I got the circle pad.
Yeah, that's probably on my list of things to get, because I'm, as a lefty, it was just so much of a pain trying to play Kid Icarus without that circle pad.
Oh yeah, no, I'm sure.
Going back to the cross-buy with Monster Hunter, so does it work that if I buy the 3DS, I automatically get the Wii U or vice versa?
No, it's, unfortunately, still, I just think there was, like, bundles. But no, there was no, however, it does seem that there was some stuff you could probably not. It is Capcom.
Yeah. Capcom has not been very good with supporting Monster Hunter or...
No, not in the States.
Mega Man, yeah.
Oh, yes, no.
But they seem to be really happy with supporting DuckTales.
That's pretty cool, though. You gotta get your DuckTales on.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. With going back to Dragon's Crown, the loot system, as I said, it is completely randomized. So there's that element of, you know, you don't know what you're going to get until it's over, which is the same thing that we saw in Payday 2 with their loot drop system.
Yeah.
But with Dragon's Crown, it's not like Payday where your three choices of either money, new mask component, or a weapon mod, those two are pretty significant, well, significant in terms of the metagame content. In Dragon's Crown, they basically rate loot on a scale of E, D, C, B, A, S. So, you know, like the whole ranking system. And you basically get to the point where anything below C is just not worth your time, because higher rank items will have a higher damage threshold, so a C rank may go 30 to 50 points of damage, while A goes 45 to 65 damage, something like that. And of course, like in Diablo, higher rarity items have more chances for buffs and variables and mods and stuff like that on them. So it gets to the point where you're playing a level and you may get 20 pieces of loot, and 10 to 12 of them are instantly discounted because they're ranked E to C.
Sure.
So that leaves you with 8 possibilities, and then you have to decide, oh wait, this is, you know, for a warrior, I'm an archer, so nope, get rid of that. And then that further narrows it down.
It's like Diablo in that manner, really.
And it's more like Diablo 3 in the fact that you only have each character or class has a primary attribute that affects basically their damage. So strength will affect for the Amazon, Fire, and Dwarf. Intelligence affects the two sorcerer people. And I don't know what the elf, who's the archer, I think it's dexterity, but I haven't played too far with her yet to know for sure. And it's really a shame because the world itself is beautiful. Putting aside the depictions of genders, the actual art design for the world, the environments, look amazing. And if you, like, pull up any screenshots of, like, combat or some of the boss fights, the game looks really epic. But there's just nothing, I guess, like, once you get past the glitz and the glamour, there's not a lot there to really hold my interest compared to something like Diablo 2 or even Drox Operative, which I've been playing again it's a game that obviously doesn't have the same graphical style as Dragon's Crown, but the gameplay is a lot more endearing. There's a lot more of that progression, you know, I just want to keep playing to get better stuff for my ship. And the same can definitely be said about Payday, too. I mean, on the cast, everyone basically agreed that we loved, like, that kind of loot drop system for the game. It gave, like, a nice reward. Now, with Dragon's Crown, I guess it's one of those games where if you have three friends, I guess similar to Payday or Diablo or whatever, it's definitely more fun when you have human people instead of the AI.
Oh, yes.
But I think it may be a little bit harder to find people unless, you know, you have the local play on the Vita or you have a constant PS3 connection. But I do think the PS3 version does have local co-op, but that I'm not 100% sure of.
Amazon looks absolutely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. And you know what's really bad about this game if you have a family is that when you go to the pause screen, they have a huge screenshot of the character on the right-hand side. So if you're playing the Sorceress or the Amazon, they're basically standing in their little pose, you know, completely taking up the right-hand side of the screen.
Nice.
So this is one of those games where you do have to, you know, make sure that no one's around who's going to judge you or, you know, wait till the family's out. And that's also one of the reasons why I chose the wizard and the elf classes first, because they're the two, I guess, I wouldn't say gender neutral, but they're the two most, I guess, realistic looking characters of the main cast.
Yeah.
And if you think that's bad, if you haven't Googled any of the screenshots for the item shop, the woman shopkeeper yet, that's another just great one. You know, you have to make sure don't go to the shop when there's someone watching kind of deal. Mm-hmm. It's, and that's the thing, it's overtly sexualized, but it just feels, like, really random in that sense. Like shopkeeper, she looks like a supermodel. The priest or pastor or whatever in the church, he looks like this giant-chested guy, but he's completely covered. And then you have another guy who's like, you're a barbarian, who's, you know, abs on top of abs on top of abs. But then, like I said, most of the game's sexualized image fall on the women. So there's more cases of that, and it just really seems like something that was, I don't know if it was put there just for controversy's sake, but it just feels like they could have added more, I guess, men sexualized just to offset the fact that they have, you know, women, like, you're probably looking at the screenshots right now.
Oh, yes.
Of the women like that.
Oh, yes.
Now, as someone who hasn't played Dragon's Crown, and you're looking at these images, have you seen any of the males yet? Like, if you Google dwarf, fighter, or even sorcerer or wizard, you'll be able to see what the men look like.
Oh, yeah, no, I've seen a couple of shots. Like, the wizard is pretty standard anime looking, really.
And then, of course, the dwarf and fighter are completely over-exaggerated. The dwarf, obviously, his entire chest is like this giant balloon of muscle.
Oh, yeah. He's got the giant beard. He looks like Greek or something.
Yeah. And that's where I think, as you said earlier, that this issue is so very murky on, is that on one hand, you have the men who look like that, and then obviously they have the women who are as exaggerated even more than that, but at the same time, when you throw in the world, and, like, when you're going around and you're seeing images like the shopkeeper, various female NPCs, it definitely leans more towards women being sexualized, I think.
Sure.
Now, what do you think in terms, I guess here's, the difficult question. Do you find it, I guess, you know how to put this, are you bothered at all by the art style, or are you more, like, neutral like I am?
I'm pretty neutral. It doesn't do, you know, I mean, obviously, I'm not that into it. But it's kind of one of those things where it's hard to argue certain points because it's, you know, you don't have to buy it. You don't have to like it. And sure, it's sexist, but okay, you know.
It's sexist for everyone, but there's definitely more sexualized for the women. Sure. And as you said, though, we can't really say, no, this cannot be made. We must ban it forever. Of course not.
No, of course, yeah.
And that's where I'm sort of middle of the road about it, because I can't completely be on the side, you know, this is perfectly fine. There is nothing wrong with it. Or I can't be saying, you know, this is horrible. We must boycott it and all that. Because it is that middle type thing.
Well, Well, it comes down to, or at least this is very important to me, is it fun? You know? I mean, I know Tom hates that word, and I understand why, but I love to use it, because it is an easy catch-all. I don't have to go into some philosophical freaking debate every time I want to say something's enjoyable. But if the game's fun, and yet, I mean, the artwork's horrible or offensive, it is kind of hard to really fault it that much. I mean, the point of the game, the point of all video games, or games in general, for the most part, unless there's some other stated artistic purpose, is to enjoy, is to make a challenge for someone. If it fails on that level, I think the game fails no matter what. But if it's decent, then it's still sexist. it's just at least worth noting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because a lot of offensive games are really terrible games, too.
Mm-hmm. Like American McGee's Bad Day in L.A.
BMX Triple X. You know, all the crappy, stupid, like, shot games, like the Columbine games. All those games are freaking awful. So, and they're offensive, so, you know, there's really no excuse for it. It's,
Now, with Dragon's Crown gameplay, there is a lot of content. Essentially, there's three different difficulty levels, and each time you beat one, they basically raise the level cap for that character. There's a random level dungeon that you can go through. So there's definitely content on that front, but as I'm going to be writing about next week, a lot of it just feels padded out to me. Someone who was praising the game said that the game doesn't start till level 50, and someone else said, you know, the game doesn't start till level 99. And that's one of the things that I really don't like to hear about a lot of video games. I don't like to play games where I'm forced to basically do busy work until, you know, I get to the chocolate center.
Oh, you, man, you must have hated that, what, Final Fantasy 13?
Oh, yeah.
Was it 13 or 14?
15
or 20, I don't know. Whichever one that had, like, the 19-hour tutorial.
I think it was 14, yeah. It was, like, a 20-hour tutorial.
That's the craziest thing.
I got as far as, I think, hour one and a half. It was, like, done.
Yeah,
I'll come back.
I played through the whole, like, tutorial part. I played a little bit of the open world and was done with it. I don't know, it just didn't capture me. But yeah, games like that are, you could make the same argument for Diablo 2 and 3, where you can't really count Diablo 3 as a game to a lot of people until you get past the normal playthrough.
Mm-hmm.
It's attacks.
Yeah, and that's always like a weird thing because I wasn't as bothered about Diablo 3 as I went on, but then again, they did unlock the monster power feature so you can make the game harder for yourself and at the same time get more loot and greater chance for uniques that way.
Right, but having to go through the game on normal just to get to that, I think is what people consider. It's just the fact that you have to, the idea of having to work to get to the game proper, and Fable 3 was like that for me, honestly. It really bothers me.
Yeah, and that's why I also like games where I either can control the difficulty of the game, something like The World Ends With You, where you can basically dictate how easy or hard the game is and have that based on it so I don't have to worry about, you know, someone who's not me who's going to get frustrated by the game and wants it always on easy.
Right.
Or I like games where the difficulty of the game is more about you yourself. Something like Super Meat Boy or Super Mario Galaxy, where there's all these challenges, so one challenge may be set for something easy, so I could do this in 20 seconds, while someone new to the game may take a few minutes. But then there's, of course, challenges that are extra hard, but all of it is available at the same time. So it's not like I have to play 20 hours of Mario Galaxy on easy before they'll let me play the hard version of the game.
Right. No, absolutely. I think, and I think some games do the tutorial intro build-up part really well. And I think sometimes it's necessary, but I also think it goes a little overboard.
Yeah. And there's also that whole debate about if games are getting too simple these days. And we've seen that with a lot of AAA games. I know there's been some news about the new Thief game that they're supposedly, you can't shoot rope arrows anymore anywhere you want. They have to be a button prompt. And he automatically jumps.
Oh, automatically?
Yeah, like there's only areas that he can have, like a space that's the only place where he can jump as a character.
That sounds pretty awful. I mean, the whole point of the Thief games to me were the exploration and the messing around and the figuring all all the things out. Just having complete control to screw up or succeed as you want in a certain area to an extent. If you can't jump or use your rope arrows or anything like that, it's going to be a little sad.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things that depress me about modern AAA games today is that I'm happy that they're remaking a lot of these older titles because I think a lot of them were good, but it's really hard for them to stand up. But at the same time, they're removing a lot of the soul, what made them so great in the first place.
Sure. No, and that's kind of why I'm so in love with The Witcher 2, and hell, the original Witcher even. If you want to talk about goofy collecting games, the nude cards or whatever.
Yeah.
But the Witcher game, it has so much more feeling to it, so much more heart than a lot of games. So when a game like that comes along, it's really surprising. And then there's the other line of thought, which is what Blizzard does with Diablo, which is simplifying. They really do just kind of try to distill the idea of a game as far down as it can be.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like minimalist.
It's almost like a math function. With StarCraft, you can see with their balance and their patch notes, they balance units down to the 10th decimal point. And on one hand, that is crazy, but on the other hand, it's one of the things that makes their game so popular to a lot of the competitive players, because they will dedicate themselves to that degree of care and precision.
Oh, it's like the comparison of Street Fighter to Marvel vs. Capcom. Marvel vs. Capcom has, four attack buttons. Street Fighter has six. And it's all about mechanics and frame cancels and stuff, whereas Marvel vs. Capcom is about crazy combos and just flash and craziness. So it's almost like those two games are compared to each other is like the way that StarCraft 2 is to, say, God, Age of Empires Online, or any of those games. Or Company of Heroes 2.
Yeah. Going back to Dragon's Crown, one thing that I will say is that I know it's not normal for usually a Japanese developer to keep it adding to their games. Usually, it's a one-and-done kind of release. But I do hope they continue to add more to the game, because as I said in my analysis, there's a great foundation for it. And they can just add a little bit more towards the ARPG side of things, just to get more of an investment to play in the game. I think that would help sell the game a lot more.
And it's I kind of, after talking about it for a couple of days, I kind of want to play it now, because I really the old beat-em-up kind of, it reminds me of those Capcom Dungeons & Dragons games.
I think
on the CBS2s.
I think the designer who also did the art, I think George Katani, I'm definitely butchering that name, I think he was said that he was inspired by the old-school Capcom Dungeon beat-em-up games for this one. And the game was, I think, in development. He started thinking about this game, I think, during the Dreamcast era. And it took him all this time. The original publisher dropped out, and then Atlus picked them up to finally get the game released.
Yeah, is this on the PlayStation Network?
I honestly don't know. It may be. I know they have DLC. Oh, that's one other thing I do have to mention. I didn't mention this annoyance in my analysis, but the narrator, they have the old school dungeon narrator who says, his voice, anytime you leave a building, he will repeat the same line of dialogue. You must go here and fight a dragon. Go to the tavern, get new ale. You must go here and fight a dragon. And that will repeat to the point that it was starting to drive me nuts. But there's fortunately a way you can turn off the narrator from the option menu, and there's DLC that you can make it so the five characters, you can have one of them be a narrator. It just helps your ears a little bit, but I can't see someone playing all 99 levels of this game with that same narrator voice saying the same exact thing every time you leave and enter a building. That was just, it was maddening at one point.
Oh yeah, no, I can imagine.
And if you do decide to pick it up, and for those of you listening, the DLC for the narrator voices is free for the month of August. Afterwards, I think it's going to be $5 or something. You can unlock it in-game, but it costs a super huge amount of gold to do that.
Get it while you can.
Yep. Oh, and one last thing, as you talk about with The Witcher, that you love that kind of concept of the game, that's also where I love a lot of the Shin Megami Tensei games, which I talked about on the podcast. These are games that are not meant to be, these mass appealing games. they're meant to be more on the horror side, and they kind of expect a level of maturity going into them that you don't see in a lot of AAA design games.
Yeah, I love those games. They're some of my favorites. The Persona games, specifically. Yeah. But I like Shin Megami.
Yeah, Persona was really good. The Persona 4, I played that on PS2. I know you played the golden version of that.
Oh, yes. And the regular on PS2. But yeah, I really, really like it.
And I think you can agree with me that when you're playing those types of games, you can't really, like, tune yourself out. You do have to be engaged, have to stand a chance. Yes. It's not like a Final Fantasy game where you can just hold down the basic attack command for most of the battles and just breeze through on that end.
Yeah, no, it's, just the inner workings of the, summoning and, like, the control of the different personas and the different demons you have in the two games. It has to be half the game. I mean, all the collecting you have to do, all the combining, all the, like, busy work that ends up, you know, and it reminds me of, like, Final Fantasy VII getting all the, different materias and stuff like that. It's just, there's a lot going on there.
Yep, and as I talk about on the cast, the latest one, Shin Megami Tensei 4, was just released on the 3DS, and I definitely enjoy that one. There's just like a few little issues. It's both easier and harder at the same time compared to other ones, but by the fact that it's easier because there is no permadeath. You can just reload from a fight. You can save anywhere. But at the same time, it's harder because they raise the attack stats of everyone, your guys and the enemies. So most people can't survive like a round or two of direct combat. So it makes combat very fast, and one round can basically dictate who wins. And I know for a lot of people, that may not sound that great. One round, you know, one lucky round, your entire party wipes. But it works by the fact that you have that same control. You know, if the enemy accidentally hits one of my guys who's resistant to his attack, I can basically follow through on my round, just wipe out the entire enemy group.
Oh yeah, exactly.
The only real complaint is the whole map system. It just gets a little annoying having to wander around the overworld trying to figure out where you're supposed to go. But that isn't as bad in the other Shin Megami Tensei games, like the Persona series, Strange Journey, those types of games.
Right.
Yep, so I think we've just had, you know, a 30-minute, half-hour about Japanese game design, which is good.
Yeah, that's good. I like that.
Yep, so I guess to wrap up this little segment, Dragon's Crown, I would say, look, you know, see how it plays, watch some videos, and then decide about it. And you, like, it is debate about whether or not it is completely sexist or if it's more fair, but it's definitely more overtly sexualized than other games out there. And of course, try The Witcher 2, try Persona, Shin Megami Tensei 4.
Absolutely.
Alright. And the reason we just spent 30 minutes on JRPG design is that there really wasn't any news this week. We were trying to find something before the cast, and there hasn't been anything, you know, really big and shocking to talk about.
No.
So I've been talking about Dragon's Crown, which I've been playing. We talk about, we're not going to do Payday 2 because we are pretty much Payday 2 spent from last night. So, Jason, what other games have you been playing lately?
Just League of Legends, really. League of Legends and, I don't know, there's probably one or two other little things. But it takes up most of my time, and I'm not playing Payday 2.
Mm-hmm. Now, League of Legends, of course, have they done any major like updates lately to it? Because I haven't played it in, I want to say at least year and a half.
Yeah, there's actually been a few things going on. I was surprised when I came back. I take a break every year and come back, you know, and back and forth. I've played quite a bit, but between the last break, there was a lot of changes. They released a new mode called ARAM, which stands for All Random, All Middle. Mm-hmm. And when you play that mode, it randomizes your characters, pixeling, and it's all just one giant center lane. So the games are pretty fast, and it's all team fight based.
Mm-hmm.
They have a couple of different weapons like they do in Dominion kind of thing, but it's pretty neat.
Is Dominion popular at all? Because I remember that was starting around the time that I left, and I don't know how it was received after that.
It was, you know, I have not played a game of Dominion in a really long time. Now, that's not to say I don't like Dominion. I actually do, but I've always been just so fascinated by Summoner's Rift and Standard Game that that's mostly what I've played. However, they have added co-op versus AI for it, so there is that option. And they've also redesigned Twisted Tree Line, which a lot of people may not know is the 3v3 map. Was normally League of Legends has a 5v5 theme. So Twisted Tree Line is a 3v3 map, and it's been redesigned to kind of incorporate parts of Dominion. Like there are certain seals you can capture, and then they have like a cooldown where no one can capture them, but they give like a giant bonus or whatever, overall bonus to one of the teams. And there's two on the map there. They've taken a lot of the jungle out of it. It made it like a good bit smaller. It plays pretty quick. I actually want to play a bit more of it. I've only played a few rounds. But other than that, really the big things with League of Legends have been the tournaments and the different options for viewing. Like they added this spectating client to the game a while back. But now they've done a lot of work with it. It has kind of like a guided camera that'll take you to possible action areas and stuff like that, which is really neat. And also, they offer all sorts of games you can spectate on the front page of like Platinum and Diamond players and above that you can just watch in your client. And it's been evolving really well.
And wasn't League of Legends, wasn't like the big news was that they were considered now like an actual sport, like in terms of people can, other countries can just travel to the United States on like a competitor's passport?
The week or whatever, like the short term. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like considered an actual sport here to the point where, yeah, you don't have to go through a ton of rigmarole to come here. For that.
Is StarCraft 2 the same way at this point?
I believe so. I could be wrong, but I believe so. I thought it was like kind of an overall esports thing has been recognized, and not just League of Legends, so it might have included StarCraft 2 in that.
Now, with League of Legends, had they done any kind of changes to like their whole metagame or, you know, rising up in Summoner's rank and unlocking new champions on that end?
Not a lot. They've redesigned a few champs. You still go 1 through 30, though. There is a tutorial, several tutorials now, and it kind of, like, gates what matches you can play as you level up initially. And then once you hit 30, you can start doing the ranked matches. But other than, like, a while back when they did this huge redesign on some of the runes, there hasn't been a ton of changes.
Mm-hmm. Now, with League of Legends, I know, of course, the other big competitor is Dota 2. Do you play that at all?
I haven't in a while, but I have played Dota 2 a fair amount. Not some ungodly amount, but I've played it a fair amount.
Because I played a little bit of Dota 2. I probably played more League of Legends, and I found the concept, like the whole meta game thing, very interesting, but I just found the gameplay to be a little too stressful for me, really, to play.
I didn't... Dota 2 is such a different animal. It's a more brutal game than League of Legends, and in a way it is. They're two different kind of approaches, though. You know, with League of Legends, a lot of the time it's about positioning, and it's about team composition and stuff like that. And in Dota, it's kind of the powers in Dota do a lot more damage right off because there's like not a lot of modifiers. You know, like in League of Legends, you have AP. Pump those up really far, and they have all sorts of stuff you can add. But like Dota, you can boost your stats and everything, but it doesn't have quite the swing that it does. They start off powerful and they just get more powerful, but they're pretty static. So yeah, it's kind of a weird comparison. They are two different games.
Now I know Dota 2 has the like a meta game like item unlock, so like the cosmetic stuff we see in Team Fortress right. 2. Did League of Legends ever add anything like that, except besides, like, the... I know they had premium costumes, premium skins like that.
Yeah, they have that, and, you know, I've seen something about, like, custom wards and stuff, but I don't think that they've implemented it yet, or if it is, it isn't fully baked.
Okay.
But, yeah, their skins are their big thing. And of course, the fact you can buy champions with money or points. You can buy rune pages with money or points.
So. Are you playing the game mostly at the tournament level, or I mean ranked matches, or do you usually just play like a random game or custom game?
I've played a lot of ranked. I'm doing really terribly right now. I had really bad fortune in my placement this season. I got kind of stuck in what they call the old Elo hell. But otherwise, I've been playing a lot of just normal games, messing around with new characters and stuff. It's both a good time. I'm coming up on my... I'm actually not too far off of having 1,000 normal games on this profile, because the old profile that I had in the beta got deleted, as everyone else's did, so lose some games here and there.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess we were just talking about in terms of ELO hell. For those of you who don't know, League of Legends features a ranking system that determines what level competitors you're going to play with, both on your team and against, when you're playing a ranked game. So if you keep losing, they're going to place you with lesser skilled people to compensate. If you keep winning, it'll be vice versa. So what makes League of Legends, and to some extent Dota 2, such a, I would say, spirited match, or heated for people who have played it, is that if you lose, even if it's not your fault, if you get a bad team, that basically affects your subsequent matches.
Yes. Yes, it does. And that is what happened to me big time in my placement matches. I was stupid. I was trying to play support, and I should have played a little bit more aggressive, but I was off to a good start. And the last, two matches I played that if I'd won would have put me in a higher bracket, at least one of them, I both got two duo queue guys, which meant the other team probably had duo queue or harder players on them. Mm-hmm. And the guys on my team that were queued together, they suck. Mm-hmm. And then, I got them again in the next match. Of all the people in the freaking world that were playing the game, I got them a second time. I should have just dropped, or I shouldn't have played the second match or something, but I did.
And with League of Legends and Dota 2, there's also a drop statistic. So if you drop too many times, they may punish you on that front.
Yes, and I try not to ever drop, just mm-hmm. because, you never know. Things may seem hopeless, but they're not.
Mm-hmm. With both League of Legends and Dota 2, there's definitely that case where, when a team starts losing, unless, you're playing with the professional esports player, chances are you're going to keep losing. Because every time someone gets beaten, the other team gets gold, which they can use to buy better items so they can kill you better, get more gold, and so on.
And now more, also, almost as importantly, if not more importantly, is that person on your team is then out of the game for a time period. And if they're not leveling, and they're not getting money, and they're not building up, and the enemy is, then you're at a huge disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. And there's definitely a lot of nuanced gameplay to both League of Legends and Dota 2 that if you have never played the game before, you will have no idea what it's about.
Yeah, they're all tough. I have not played the Dota 2 stuff to see if they have a tutorial or anything yet, but the League of Legends one is decent. But they're both games that require, if you want to continue to play them, they're going to require you to watch guides or watch videos or watch tournaments and familiarize yourself with terms and builds and stuff like that.
Yeah. I guess here's a general question. What, I guess, in your opinion, is the key difference between a game like League of Legends and a game like Dota 2 for the people who are listening and have, no idea what we're talking about?
Well, there's a few. One of them is, or more than one probably, I guess, are haste related. To me, League of Legends, it follows its Warcraft 3 roots from Dota, where everything is relatively colorful, and it's all cartoony sprite-based kind of thing. And it's just, it uses this huge array of different bright colors to do all the different abilities and spells and stuff. And, that's not to say there's no dark parts of it as well. There are, but it uses a full spectrum. Whereas Dota 2 is a, kind of a grittier game. It has the, dark, and the abilities look kind of realistic. And to me, I like the League of Legends way because I have a much easier time differentiating what's going on in League of Legends matches when it gets hectic than I do in Dota 2. I just end up being dead in Dota 2 and have no idea what happened. And then there are slight gameplay differences, and well, one of them's not so slight. In Dota, you can kill your own little troop guys, which requires a touch of explanation from your base in these games. These little dudes, they stream out and they stream towards the other player's base, and the whole point of the game is to destroy the enemy's base. So these guys are fodder, and you get experience from them, and if you kill them, you get money from them. By kill them, I mean get the last point of damage done to them, you get the money. Well, that's called last hitting, and that exists in Dota and League of Legends. But what doesn't exist in League of Legends that exists in Dota is denying, where you kill your own creep, and you don't get any money, you don't get any experience for it, but you kill your own unit to deny the enemy from doing it. And it's just kind of an extra layer of
Extra mental hurdle almost.
Right. And I kind of prefer League of Legends over this as well, just because I don't want to deal with denying. Some people love the denying aspect, and that's great. It's just something I never enjoyed that much as a part of the game. Realistically, after that, it really gets down to the way the champions work. In Dota 2, you can go up into the mid-20s in your character levels. Several characters have a bunch of powers. A few of them have only a couple of powers, or three or four. But you don't have the system that League of Legends does, which is four powers, three of them normal, one of them ultimate, plus a passive. In Dota, you have just kind of a random assortment of powers that you level up, and you put a certain amount of points in them up to, like I said, in the mid-20s. But you can also choose as your level, and you will have to eventually, because you'll run out of powers to build, you can choose to up all your stats. Whereas League of Legends, you go to level 18, there's exactly 18 points worth of powers. And your character has a passive ability, which is not always the case in Dota 2. Character controls in Dota 2, I feel, are a little bit more advanced.
Yeah, I know with Dota 2, they have that little thing that can bring items back and forth from your home base to you.
Yeah, they have like a donkey or mule or whatever, and then you can upgrade that to a flying one. And you can choose to control it by clicking on it, kind of like you would in a regular RTS, which is another throwback from the fact Dota comes from Warcraft 3, Warhammer, basically. And in the original Dota, you would have to select your character. The powers that you used weren't always Q, W, E, and R. They were all sorts of different random key placements. Now, you could, of course, rebind them, whatever you wanted to play. But you had to select your character. It wasn't just like you could click and go wherever like you do in League of Legends or Dota 2 is now. You had to always choose your character. It was easy to click off of them and then have to go back and find them. All of these things come down to, for me, that Dota 2 is almost an exact copy of Dota, which they programmed in, like little weird hitches, stuff like that, from the original Warcraft engine. But it's a very faithful recreation. But I would say that League of Legends is probably easier to grasp at first, but they're both relatively easy to get into, and they're both free. There's no reason to not try both of them.
And they both, speaking about free, they both have a pretty good microtransaction model. Neither game you can really buy, you can't really buy advantages in either game.
Right.
Like compared to other free-to-play games where you can buy, extra armor or extra ammo. Essentially, the microtransaction is completely separate from the actual gameplay.
For the most part. Now, I mean, I do have to say there is a slight caveat, which someone did point out. Is a good point. The Dota 2, when you play it, you have all the characters unlocked from the get-go. You do not in League of Legends. And where that can be harmful, and they do put out updates, basically. Or not updates. Like, every week there's a new round of random characters that they make free. But to actually get good at one, of course, you're going to have to buy one. Now, you don't have to use money to do that. But one of the big things that is kind of a leg up is with money you can purchase IP boosts, which give you extra points from your games during a certain time period. You can buy those with Riot points, and I don't know if you can buy them with IP. You might be able to. I have no idea, but there are slight advantages League of Legends gives you, but they're so incredibly slight that they don't actually honestly affect the in-game part of it. It's more of a more of a kind of a extra money for purchasing your runes part of it.
Okay. And when you do reach that higher level, of course, having more champions will make you a better player, but if you don't have the skill to really use them well, then it's just basically you're throwing money out the window.
Right, which I think a lot of people need to realize that League of Legends characters, as much as I love them, a lot of them are redundant. So, you know, the playable accepted character list is not quite the same as the available character list.
Okay. All right. I think with that, we'll move on. That's a good segue to the topic of this week.
Okay.
So, this week I made a post about video game addiction. As Tom pointed out last night, I was busy I was flipping through the channels. I stumbled on Katie Couric's talk show, which is, of course, a great thing to do when you're busy watching TV. And apparently she was doing a special, it was a repeat about video game violence. And, you know, it's your usual same thing, you know.
Of course. The
expert comes on and says it's video games violence is causing, you know, kids to become criminals. Someone lost their job because they got hooked on Call of Duty because of the violence. And, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff like that. But where I do see some of the points that video games have become more addicting over the years.
Sure.
Addictive, might I say. And part of that is due to the change in game design. Over the last decade, we've seen a lot of games become more simplified. And this is what we talked about earlier in the cast, that we see a lot of AAA games are aimed more toward your mass market compared to niche experiences.
Yeah.
And because of that, it makes it a lot easier for someone to sit down and pick up and play a game compared to if someone wants to sit down and, you know, play a game like League of Legends or even something like Crusader Kings 2, for instance.
Right.
And so the debate where I'm sitting is there's definitely a lot of games aimed at getting your money or getting you to keep playing.
Oh, sure.
We see this with Call of Duty, a lot of free-to-play games. I know World of Tanks used to be like that. I don't know how they've changed since their big monetization removal update they had.
Yeah, I don't know, actually. I haven't played it much lately.
Mm-hmm. But we see this with a lot of free-to-play games where they're designed to basically not exactly come out and say, you need to give us, you know, $20. But they sort of, like, nudge and wink and say, you know, if you give us $5 here, we'll give you extra character. Or give us $2 here and we'll let you get through this part easier.
Right.
I know Marvel Heroes, which Tom raved about, but he also said that it was definitely more on the monetized end of things with how much things cost in that game.
Yeah.
Did you play Marvel Heroes at all? Because I haven't.
I played a little bit. Everything is super expensive in it, yeah.
And so this is where we can sort of debate is obviously some of the best games we've played, like Payday 2, like Saints Row 4 and other great games, they're engaging and they make us want to sit and play them for hours on end. But at the same time, that's the same kind of actions that someone would take who's addicted to, you know, a game like Farmville or a game like Call of Duty. So is it all right for games to have addictive qualities to them? Or is it one of those things that it's something we really can't completely control? What do you think?
It's kind of a big subject. I mean, because really, if you think back to it, there was a lot of control based on video games earlier in their life because they were in the arcade or they were barred by really expensive hardware.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as consoles became popular and computers started, permeating everybody's home, you remove this monetary barrier of entry. You end up being able to just play Call of Duty for 20 hours a day if you want to. Now, if it was going to be an epidemic, there's a lot of people on Earth, as far as I'm told. And one of them losing their job, being an asshole, and staying home all day and playing Call of Duty is not a huge story.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the fact that there's millions and millions and millions and millions upon millions of video game players, and not every one of us is out murdering.
Mm-hmm.
We're not all planning school shootings and stuff. Sometimes it's not literal, but everybody likes to take things literally. They like to take things at face value. It's an easy jump from point A to point B. Oh, well, he played video games about shooting people, then he went and shot people. It doesn't take a lot of imagination, but it quiets parents down. It gives people something to vilify.
Yeah.
And it's happened throughout history with everything that has been entertainment. In fact, if you look at the last 100 years, it's a huge cycle. It's television. It's music. It's movies. It's, you know, violence this, violence that, and all that. Mm-hmm. And as the opponents of, unfortunately, sometimes they die off. It becomes accepted, and this is part of a growing pains of a industry that is becoming and has become a juggernaut. Eventually, in 30 years, I doubt it'll be that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what you're just saying, that jump from point A to point B, a lot of people don't look deeper into the person themselves, because as you said, not everyone who plays video games is going to run out and shoot someone or, you know, completely close themselves off. There's people out there who and this is where my opinion is, that the people who are the extremes, the ones who give up everything and play a video game, or the ones who sadly commit these crimes, I feel they were probably going to do it in some fashion with or without video games. Video games may have been the trigger for, you know, this particular incident, but if it wasn't video games, something would have set them off, I think.
Oh, sure. And that's the thing. Of course it would have. If you're an absolutely horribly imbalanced person, you know, say what you will, blame what you will, but something's going to happen eventually. And, you know, it's just easy. It's easier for people to wrap their minds around that than just to say, well, maybe he was just a crazy person. Maybe he was.
Yeah. Now, with video games, as we said, they have become more engaging, and there's definitely a big difference between a game that's engaging like Civilization or Crusader Kings 2 or any like high-level thinking game, something that really requires you to sit down and, you know, analyze for hours on end, versus a very monetized game like Marvel Heroes, Farmville, and those types of games where they're basically using, you know, all these little tricks to try to make the game have more value than what is really there.
Right.
And so with Call of Duty, while it is considered the poster child for the super violent type games, I think more of the pull of the game is the psychological factor of the progression model of the game.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's one of the most intoxicatingly addicting features in modern gaming history, in my opinion. I've spent hours upon hours playing that game just for that sheer fact, and I enjoyed every minute of it.
And it's designed to basically give you that sense that you're making progress, you're getting more powerful, you unlock a new achievement.
Yep.
And all these factors are basically making you want to keep playing. And the question is, that is different from having engaging gameplay. These are more like the side mechanics or supplemental systems. Now, are these types of systems, would you say it's okay to have them, or do you think that they're more on like the vilified end of things?
Oh, you know, for the most part, I'm pretty happy to let people do whatever they want, specifically with video games. There's always been something to tempt weak people. You know, it doesn't change. It can be alcohol, it can be drugs, it can be gambling, it can be whatever. People with addicting personalities are going to get addicted. However, I don't think any blame should really be held on the game companies for something like that. Now, I mean, if, you know, they start sending out, like, heroin or something, that would totally just, like, make you obsessed with their game, and they trick you out of all sorts of money, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's different. But stuff like the Call of Duty level grind, all that, no, I don't fault them any for that. That's just intelligent gameplay.
Now, moving from Call of Duty, I think because parents tend to focus on violence, I think they don't see the clear picture when we talk about addictive qualities or monetization elements in other games. Case in point would probably be the whole Plants vs. Zombies 2 release. That's, I think it's out right now on iOS devices, and it's going to be on the PC later. Is that
Is it out now? Because I know they released it in Australia for a time. I've really wanted to try it out, and I never did the, I guess it is out now. You know. But yeah, see you later.
But, like, with that case, that's a game that it's not super violent, it's more family friendly, But there's a lot more monetized elements to that game, a lot more ways to get people to keep spending money. And I think something like that is definitely more on the dangerous side for younger people. Sure. You know, if they get hold of a credit card or something like that, they can run that thing up incredibly fast. And like we see in a lot of those types of free-to-play games, so they have, you know, the price list, you know, they always have that super big, you know, like, spend $500 and we'll give you something special like that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's, you know, it's one of those things where it comes down to, it's just one of the dangers of the mobile device. If you have all your stuff saved and you don't have, like, a child lock on it, then yeah, I mean, you might get burned on that one. Mm-hmm. That's kind of one of those things where it comes down to choice for a parent, too. Are you going to save your stuff in your phone and then just give your child free reign of it? Then maybe you kind of deserve that.
Now, with a lot of, I guess, really great games, I guess my question to you is, when we talk about games that are very endearing video games, like the Mario games, like Payday, like any game that makes you want to sit hours and hours on end, what do you think makes those games different from addictive games like Call of Duty, like free-to-play games where they try, you know, get you to keep playing, get you to keep spending money?
Well, I would say, I would argue that Payday is very similar to Call of Duty in its implementation of things. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, you gain levels, you unlock more stuff, you earn money to personalize your character. It's kind of this ungodly bastardization of role-playing games, yeah, which has brought on this, like, whole new era of the way games work. To the point where people are upset if there's no unlockables, you know. There's, oh, mm-hmm, how can I play this? There's no weird RPG framework to base my shooting, mm-hmm, upon. And I like it quite a bit, but it's just part of kind of, in my opinion, the evolution of game. You know? Mm-hmm. We're coming up with new ways to add depth to video game experiences that might not have been possible before. So I just think that we'll see more and more different ways to pile in gameplay and meta gameplay.
And that's definitely going to get more as we see basically digital distribution online systems become more involved as consoles start to become always on. There's a whole big debate with Microsoft along that lines. They've sort of eased off on it, but we're still not completely sure until release. We're definitely becoming more of a digital industry. I mean, look at the indie market. They've lived and thrived and grown by the fact that they don't need to worry about retail copies of their games.
Absolutely. I think that's a great thing. Stuff like, mm-hmm, things like Steam and Desura and all those things, they've done a lot for game distribution and the actual game development community as well.
Mm-hmm. And with the monetized aspect, that's also where a lot of the DLC and microtransactions come from. As more games are being released with that additional content you can buy, and that takes into a whole discussion on, you know, nickel and diming. That's a whole nother can of worms we could talk about at another point.
Yeah, that's, God, you know, and the DLC thing, I think Tom said it best. We were having this discussion once a while back, and he was like, you know, people can complain about it all they want, but it's, you know, they did it.
Mm-hmm.
By actually purchasing it, buying into it and everything, they encourage the company. So, I mean, apparently we have told them that that's what we want, and then we decided we don't want it. But it's way too late for that now. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also kind of like a fine line. Now, if, for instance, they worked up to the moment on making sure their game was chock full of good stuff and everything, then released it, and then they want to add on to their game later on,
mm-hmm,
that's fine. But don't pull stuff out of the game before release. Don't, you know, mm-hmm, don't hide parts of it behind weird codes or 64K downloads or whatever, mm-hmm, little unlock switches you have to download. You know, mm-hmm, don't use my hard drive space without giving me access to my content.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and that's something that we've seen a lot with, you know, EA, Day One DLC.
Yep.
And in terms of, like, I guess with a lot of the monetization or the addictive aspects, they're trying to make you want to buy these things more, either by saying, oh, we're going to give you new stories, or, you know, the whole idea of the season pass. So you basically buy, you know, months worth of content before you even see the game.
Right, right, absolutely. And there are a couple of games I've done that for because I was a big fan, but usually only after I played them a bit. Like Borderlands 2, I think, was a good season pass purchase. There's a lot of stuff. But yeah, it's Actually, I think Season Pass is dying off for some of them, isn't it? Like, isn't EA stopping that stuff, or is it?
They stopped the whole Project $10 thing, where you had to, if you bought a used copy of the game, you had to spend $10 to unlock any retail content.
Right, or you gotta be able to play on Live, or all that jazz. Yeah, that's right.
Going back to the whole issue with parents and the addictive qualities, I think as you said earlier, with it's so easy to make that trace from point A to point B, the other problem is that when someone talks about video games, they basically, you know, say video game, they lump the industry as one big ball of evil.
Oh yeah.
Where the video game industry really isn't that centralized. I mean, there's organizations like the IGDA, what's the other one?
ESA.
ESA.
Yeah, no, and it's the reason that everybody lumps everything together is it's a lot easier to hate just one big thing before you start looking at the good thing. It's real easy to not dig into it and just have somewhere to point your rage without having to.
And that hurts their arguments pretty much for a lot of us, because we know that not everyone, that video games aren't defined by the Call of Duties or the Halos or the World of Warcrafts.
The most exciting things in video games are happening on a very small scale, too, with indie games, and a lot of times. And, you know, that the world's just, you know, and like everything's just picking up as it goes. So, gaming is coming into a golden age, I hope.
Yeah. And, I mean, in terms of the general perception, there's probably a lot of people there who don't even know, you know, about the whole Kickstarter craze that's happening
right
over the year. And there's probably some people out there who have no idea what Steam is.
I'm sure there's plenty of people, you know. We take for granted that our colleagues are very into gaming, but yeah, there's huge subsets of people that have no earthly idea what we're talking about. But that's just another world out there for people to explore, you know.
Yep. And it'll be interesting to really see how the industry continues to grow throughout this decade, both in terms of design and online play, and just in terms of who's going to still be around, because that's still really up in the air in terms of the AAA market.
Yeah, no, it really is. It's a weird industry. 20 years ago, I would have never imagined a world without Sierra or LucasArts. Here we are.
And 15 years ago, I never thought I would be buying games through my internet connection and, you know, not even having boxes anymore to save.
Yeah, no, it is weird. I have a huge collection. I actually got rid of a lot of them. I had to. I had boxes. Had boxes and boxes of boxes. So it seemed a little ridiculous. But I still have some of my old classics, my Monkey Island, etc. I kind of miss those days, but at the same time, God, I love the community.
Yeah, definitely. Never have to deal with DOS again. Never have to deal with, you know, 40-digit CD keys and passwords.
Have to go to GameStop.
Yeah. GameStop around me closed, so there's not even like a place within walking distance anymore.
There's a few around here.
I guess the last question then for this cast, obviously there's a lot more we can talk about in terms of games that are addicting versus those that are just endearing. Are there any, like, trends, like, that you're seeing from people that you talk to or that you have an idea about that's going to happen with online play? Like, what do you think is the next step as we move more into this digital and online world?
You know, that's a good question. I think as far as online goes, a lot of people should probably pay attention to ArenaNet and Guild Wars 2, because, I mean, they really do offer quite a bit there. It's a very service-based game and company. And I think you're going to start seeing a lot more free-to-play. You're going to see a lot more people experiment with the concept of, you know, giving away the base game. And I hope and pray that that leads to a renaissance to the point of if people are forced to live or die by their success in the gaming industry, then maybe we'll see better games.
All right, so I think we're going to wrap it up here. Definitely, this is one of those conversations that we could probably talk a few more hours about, and we could probably come back to this later on, maybe with a larger panel.
Yeah.
So, with that said, Jason, it was great to have you on this week.
Be here.
Hopefully, we can play some Payday later.
Yeah, I might. God, so much League of Legends and Payday to do.
Yeah. And as always, for those of you listening, if you would be interested in being a future guest on the cast or contributing a piece to Game Wisdom, you can email us through the Submissions Wanted link on the front page. That's where you'll find our email and what we're looking for in terms of articles. With that said, thank you for tuning into the Perceptive Podcast this week. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.